Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 105, my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, it's crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen to us at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesdays on PRN.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. So if you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. This week's mailbag, Carol on the podcast page wrote, "Congratulations on 100 shows, David." Justin via email wrote, "I recently found your show. I've been listening to Expanding Mind for several months and only recently decided to check out other shows PRN offers and was delighted to find yours. So far, I have listened to the February 9th show on the War with Men, the April 5th show on sexual assault, and part of the May 31st show on AIDS and cancer. I look forward to hearing more. I gather that you are no stranger to controversy and vitriol. From a quick bit of Googling, I see that you've caused a stir in the HIV/AIDS world, and I hear that you say that someone accused you of being a rape apologist or some such thing. I'm sure it can often feel quite discouraging to have your attempts to bring clarity to a topic met with such vitriolic responses. I sure hope you don't get too discouraged, because the world has far too few people courageous, curious, and eloquent enough to intelligently question dogmas and received wisdom. You are desperately needed. Thank you for bravely putting your well-reasoned voice out there. No matter how much I may disagree with you on some topics, I promise I will continue to defend your dogma-exposing endeavor, because the world needs more people like you. Thank you so much, Justin." Today, let's talk about the artist Van Gogh, Vincent Van Gogh. While famous to almost the status of a cliché in the modern world, his life was an unmitigated disaster, unable to gain acceptance either as a human being or as an artist. And as you will see in this discussion, we don't just talk about art. My guest today is Stephen Nafee, who is a lawyer but also an art expert, who's written books on Van Gogh and Jackson Pollock, among other subjects. One of the fascinating questions about Van Gogh has been why he committed suicide while still quite young. Our guest asks whether he did commit suicide or, in fact, was murdered. The book is about the entire life of Van Gogh, and we'll go through that. Stephen graduated from Harvard Law School in 1977 and also did graduate work in fine arts at the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard. He has written alone and frequently with Gregory White Smith on art. The biography of Jackson Pollock won a Pulitzer in 1991, and it was a collaboration, and also formed the basis of the Academy Award-winning film Pollock from 2000. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, so...
Delighted to be here.
Yes. So there must have been a lot of biographies about Van Gogh, so what made you want to write another one?
Well, we had written our biography of Jackson Pollock, and... It was astonishing that no one had written a big biography of Pollock either. But there really wasn't a lot done at the time in the field of art biography. There were terrific biographies of writers and of politicians and even military figures, but art history had been sort of anti-biographical, which turned out to be terribly helpful to Greg and me, because a figure as important as Jackson Pollock was there to be approached virtually for the first time with any major ambition.
And so you said...
I can't imagine... Go ahead.
You said that art history is anti-biographical?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's taken a turn. In the 25 years plus since we began working on... well, actually, more than that. It's been 30-some-odd years since we began working on Jackson Pollock. And in those three decades... some very good art biographies have been written, including one on de Kooning that also won the Pulitzer. But before we began Pollock, there was really the whole 20th century, during the whole 20th century, the field of art history was focused on a variety of interpretive methods, all of which were sort of anti-biographical. They were either Marxist or, in which case they thought the society was more important than the individual artist, or they were formalist, meaning that the sort of physical attributes of the painted surface and of the color and the lines was the focus of the art historian's interest rather than the person who actually made the painting. And as a result, there just wasn't a lot of really great art biography. It lasted long enough that by the time we began working on Van Gogh in 2000, there was still not a major biography of Van Gogh. And it wasn't just our assessment of the literature out there. If you turned back then to the bibliography in the Encyclopedia Britannica, it began with the sentence, "There is no definitive biography of Vincent Van Gogh." So it was astonishing to us that a figure of that magnitude, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps the most best known and beloved painter of all time, could have could not have been the subject of a major biography, especially because he was so perfect as a biographical subject from the other sort of critical standpoint. The life was intensely interesting, and there was sufficient material, largely because of the letters, the famous letters that Van Gogh wrote to his brother Theo. There was plenty of material there and elsewhere in order to reconstruct the life.
I mean, you could say he was, I think reading your book, you could say he was perfect because of his imperfections.
Yes, well, he led such an unhappy, complicated, but also intellectually rich life.
Yeah.
It isn't just that the life was a kind of vagabond, miserable life, but it was the life of his mind was extraordinary. I mean, he read voluminously and had a stunning memory, and he also looked at art intensely and broadly and remembered what he saw, which was terribly important at a time when there was no internet, and even art books were not, did not have color illustrations. So basically you had to carry your imaginary museum with you from your memory. You couldn't just, open up your iPhone and pull up an image. He had to, and Van Gogh had that ability. So it was, and of course he made all these masterpieces, especially in the last 2 to 4 years of his life, that it means so much to so many people. So the misery of his life was, so utterly redeemed both by the work that he created and by the both complex and intellectually extraordinary mind that he had as he confronted life's difficulties.
He basically survived off the largesse of his family because, what I read is he didn't really sell much of his work.
Well, he sold only one painting during his lifetime. He sold a few drawings, but those were sold to an uncle who was basically just finding a way to transfer money to him, and not much money. And so, even before he became a significant artist, he was depending entirely on his brother Theo, who sent him for most of the latter part of his life 150 francs a month, which was a great deal of money at the time. It was twice what a school teacher made, and it was a substantial part of Theo's income, and made all the more difficult for Theo because towards the end he was not only supporting Vincent, but he was supporting their mother and a sister named Wilhelmina, who was mentally ill.
Plus
and
his wife.
In the last 2 years, he had a wife and a child, too. So it was,
yes.
If not for Theo, we would not have, if Theo had not existed, Vincent wouldn't exist.
Right. I was going to say that Van Gogh physically survived in the terms of being able to feed himself and being able to buy paint and things like that off the largesse of his family. But, what was the motivation of his family? Did they see him as a great artist? It seemed more like they just didn't want him to die on the street of starvation.
It was multiple motivations. No, even Theo was an art dealer. In fact, Vincent, some listeners may not know, came from a family of art dealers. His uncle,
yes.
Vincent, after whom he was named, who was the leading art dealer in the Netherlands, and eventually sold his business to Goupil, which was the leading art dealer in France, and that mm-hmm. became the most important art gallery in the world. And Vincent actually went to work for the family business, and his uncle Vincent, because he had no children, intended to give the business to his nephew Vincent, the painter, and Vincent was so incompetent that he was demoted 3 times before being banned permanently from even stepping foot in the family business. But his brother Theo, at a very young age, at 15, went off to The Hague and then eventually to Paris, where he worked for Goupil and was brilliant at it. Was really, in fact, in Paris, became one of the first major dealers to show the work of the Impressionists and the new painters of their day.
Art was, according to your biography, was part of Van Gogh's life even as a child. Like, although his mother didn't seem too supportive of his art, the idea of handcrafts, making things for presents, that kind of stuff seemed to be part of that family. I don't know if it was part of other families.
Yeah, and in fact, not only the Christmas gifts, the favorite Christmas gifts were something you made, and birthday gifts, and in fact, the first drawing we have, which the Van Gogh Museum just acquired for no money. It was an astonishing purchase. It came up for sale, and it's a rather famous drawing, but nobody at the auction house seemed to know what it was. And it's a depiction of a farmyard, and it was the first known Van Gogh, and it was inscribed with his father's birthday, and was a birthday present for his father. So it was even though his mother never even what you're referring to is the fact that his mother, who outlived him by 17 years, you know, really didn't like him, and for a whole range of reasons, including his bizarre behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But she never liked the art, and even right up to her dying day, even after he was beginning to be a little famous, she didn't care for it. But she, in 19th century Holland, it was not unusual for upper-middle-class families like Vincent's to consider a certain amount of familiarity with the arts an essential part of a bourgeois life. And Mother Van Gogh was a friend of some of the Backhuizen family, and they were important Dutch painters, and some of the Backhuizen sisters came to the town where the Van Gogh family was living, and the mother went out and did watercolors with them, and so there was an interest in the visual arts, certainly in the form in the father's family. The uncle was this formidable art dealer. It's just that they didn't understand how gloriously talented Vincent was.
It seemed to me that it wasn't until Vincent Van Gogh died that his brother really realized what he had in terms of...
I think you're right. The death was so... even though they had a complicated relationship, as many siblings do, complicated massively by the fact that Theo was expected to or assumed the responsibility of paying for his brother's life, which in answer to your earlier question was done for a variety of reasons. It was partly just generous. I mean, Van Gogh could not support himself, and therefore Theo did it. It was also to protect the family from his brother's bizarre behavior, and sending him 150 francs a month was a way of sort of keeping him from causing more,
more grief.
Reputational damage to the family.
Towards the end, you describe how his brother Theo sent his wife, who had just had a baby and wasn't doing very well health-wise, sent her to Holland, and you know he avoided coming to visit Vincent on the way, which he could have easily done.
There was, in addition to the complex sibling situation, you know, not just the fact that he was having to come up with all this money for his older brother, but what Vincent referred to as an unbalanced relationship, and by that he meant he was the older brother. It was his. He should have inherited the family business. Theo should not have been the one to become the art dealer in his head, and so he was. There was always a certain sort of anger and guilt there, but it was further complicated by the fact that Theo, like Vincent, had syphilis. It was a very common disease. 1/4 of all the adult men in Paris had syphilis. And Theo eventually died of tertiary syphilis.
Well, I think we do need to talk about that since you brought it up, because I've actually done some research on syphilis, and I'm very skeptical about a lot of stories about syphilis. Prior to the early 1900s, the treatment for syphilis was mercury, and I wonder how many men who were promiscuous, and it seemed from your description that wealthier men just saw young women as a commodity, like Vincent van Gogh went to the brothels all the time, Theo had a mistress.
Wealthy men. What was astonishing, and I believe I had to read the literature on this, it was prostitution existed at all levels of society. So there were courtesans at the top level for the wealthy, and there were streetwalkers like Fien, Vincent's only relationship, at the bottom of the ladder. So it was at all different levels of society. The number of prostitutes in Paris was astonishing, and it was just sort of part of, you know, girls from the countryside who were, you know, were having an incredibly difficult time getting by, would sort of end up in Paris, and they would, if they couldn't find a job, this was the terrible calamity that many of them went through. It wasn't just common in France. There are two books on prostitution in the 19th century in Holland. It was very common in Holland, where Vincent was much of his life.
Right.
And you're right, mercury was the typical medication, and of course mercury is a terrible thing.
It's a neurotoxin, apart from knocking out your kidneys.
On top of all the other problems that Vincent had and that Theo had, the medication they were taking for it, you know, was killing them.
Yeah, I've wondered about this. I mean, what I understand about it, tertiary syphilis is nobody can find the treponeme, the bacteria that's supposed to be the cause of syphilis. But by this time, somebody's been through a lifetime of taking mercury. And in the early 1900s, when I think Paul Ehrlich came up with what was called the first magic bullet, a drug called 606, that was based on arsenic, which is apparently less toxic than mercury. And until the Second World War, the treatment for penicillin was arsenic, and then after the Second World War, they came out with penicillin, and then people got better. But it's like if you substitute a really toxic poison from an antibiotic, which for most people has no side effects, a few people obviously have allergic reactions. Yeah. Obviously, people are going to do better. But anyway, I didn't want to divert the whole interview on the subject of syphilis. But
well, it's not unimportant because Vincent, you know, suffered from a variety of disorders, and you know, we don't know for sure, but it's very hard to. I've had multiple psychiatrists who've read the book concur that he was bipolar, which is it's really sort of hard to imagine that he wasn't, given the mood swings, the intense mood swings. He was diagnosed during his own lifetime as having epilepsy, and there were people on both sides of his family, both the mother and the father's side, including one uncle and a cousin and others who had epilepsy. So it was not an uncommon thing in the family. And we think he had not chronal epilepsy, but something called temporal lobe epilepsy, which is even more terrifying. And again, the medications for it were probably did more harm than good.
Right.
And on top of this, he began in Paris drinking absinthe, which is no longer legal because it has a narcotic in it, as well as being alcohol.
Right. I thought it was poisonous, or people thought it was poisonous, but it's actually just a narcotic. But
well,
probably not
good
for you.
I know it's banned, so, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I think you know more about medications, it's sounding like, than I do. But whether it's what classification it falls under, it isn't good for you.
I think maybe you can get...
In fact, I've had one psychiatrist say that it might have been one of the triggers for the increase in the number of his epileptic episodes, starting when he arrived in Paris and started drinking it.
Yeah, well, I always like to wonder. Well, I often wonder if a lot more diseases are environmental. If we define the environment as everything that's around us, what we eat, what we
right.
drink, what we're exposed to. But another factor too with a painter is that a lot of paints back then, and probably still to some extent today, although I think they've removed some of the heavy metals, would contain lead or cadmium or other toxic metals. And I know there was one thing in your book, I didn't look through to try to find every place you maybe said this, but he was chewing on the paintbrushes, which
right,
doesn't...
You can tell me, actually, this is a question I've been having, is would chewing on your paintbrushes, dry paintbrushes, would you ingest enough of these metallic products to cause some damage? And my guess is the answer is probably yes, that you wouldn't have to ingest enormous amounts of it to cause some damage.
Right. I mean, I remember when they were trying to remove lead from paint, like house paint, and they were saying that in a lot of like poorer neighborhoods where houses are not maintained as well, you know, paint would be flaking on the walls, and children would...
And even that would cause enough for damage.
Yeah, yeah, children. But, you know, it's very difficult. It's not the kind of thing that you can really quantify. Like, you know, you might have three babies in the ghetto, and they have the same exposure to paint chips, but one of them eats 10 times as much as the others.
Right.
You know, like, every child is different in what they... in what they want, and also people are different in their susceptibilities to these things, so I don't know how you would really...
Well, it's not insignificant as well that during one of his epileptic episodes, when and during these things, during the acute phase of it, he would lose his intellectual command over himself, his control over himself, and ultimately his memory. These episodes, he would not remember what he did during them, which is one reason why they were so terrifying. And in one episode, he drank some kerosene, and that couldn't have been good for him.
No,
and I wonder if there wasn't you know, something in the paints that made the fumes of the kerosene inviting. I mean, neither of these activities could have been helpful in a life already marred by diseases that were, as you suggest, not only inherited and perhaps acquired through through a sexually transmitted fashion, but also environmental in the form of absinthe that he drank and kerosene and paint that were toxic.
Plus social influences because of the difficult childhood with his mother. Like,
absolutely. There's also the... there are some people who have argued that this epilepsy was at birth, and therefore... But that he was a cranky child for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Even as a baby. You know, some babies are just happier than other babies, and he was a cranky baby right from the start. And whereas Theo was an incredibly happy and content and
helpful,
amiable,
helpful
child.
Yes.
And you know, parents tried very hard to give all of their children, you know, equal amounts of affection and love. And you know, we're all human. And you know, Mother Van Gogh and Pa Van Gogh. It's not ununderstandable that they preferred Theo, and they said it often in their letters. They would say to Theo, you know, you're like a spring flower to us. You are our jewel and our crown.
Right.
And they were speaking both to Theo, and they were essentially referencing the other son, Vincent, who was everything but those things. It was a constant worry and the affliction of their lives. And And at a very early age, I mean, he would run out into the fields and get dirty, and he would consort with the peasants, and he would play hooky from school, and he was difficult, and all of these activities made him unacceptable in the family, and so they actually sent him off to boarding school when he was very young, and just partly to get him out of the house. And always abandonment.
And knowing what we know about boarding schools now, I was waiting for you to write that he'd been beaten or sexually abused in the boarding school, because that was just so common in those days.
I hadn't even considered that, but I'm not sure it was. You know, I went to boarding school, and nothing of those things.
Right.
I remember a hand on the knee once from some whatever.
Maybe it depends.
Nothing that scarred me for life.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
but I also remember how lonely it was.
Yeah.
You know, I went off at 14, and I think he was, I can't remember, but he was under 14. He was younger than that. And he was also the youngest boarder of anybody in the school.
Right.
And you know, I've talked to some of my fellow classmates from boarding school now that we're in our 60s, and even the cool kids, even the athletes, even the ones who had lots of friends, were miserable and lonely, it turns out, or most of them were. I was actually astonished to find out that, you know, the nerd among them, me, was not the only one who found being away from family.
Well that's what
incredibly traumatic.
I went to just a regular high school down the end of the street. well, not exactly the end of the street, but I always felt out of place. I always felt like I didn't belong, all that kind of stuff. I didn't need a boarding school to make me feel like an outsider. But I probably, if I talked to the people I went to high school with, I'd probably find that there was a lot of them who felt the same way. But, of course, we all put up a good front.
Yeah, exactly. I was just stunned. I had a school reunion recently, and I saw two guys who I hadn't seen in 40 years. And I knew one of them had left in the middle of school, and he was such a good athlete, and everybody liked him. And I asked him, why did you leave school? And he said, I was just missed my family so much. So, you know, and in Vincent's case, you know, at least in my case, I was lucky enough to have two wonderful, loving parents. And, you know, so I had the platform of a loving family, and as miserable as I was, you know, at least I could go home and recharge my emotional batteries.
Right.
But Vincent, when he'd go home, he didn't get that.
Yeah.
And he didn't have that strong foundation of family love. So I don't think he needed to be abused in this school, which seems to have been rather well run,
isolated.
To be terribly traumatic. In fact, he left one of the schools. He left that school and went to a different one. And he just left the school and walked home one day for many hours of a walk. So he really hated both of those schools.
I think
and
one of the reasons,
to them.
What you described as one of the reasons he wanted to go home was for the nature, although it sounded like it was kind of in some ways a rather blighted part of Holland. It was poor. Everybody was just scraping by, but it had kind of a stark beauty, which it appears that he appreciated from a very young age.
Well, one of the things that's so astonishing about his imagination is that he could transform, you know, what even areas that we would consider blighted into something magical. He did it with the heath in around Zundert, where he was born, which was which had a kind of stark beauty of a kind, but he even did it more astonishingly in the mine district of northern Belgium, which is on the in the towns around Mons, and these were really blighted. I mean, they were just there was a terrible pall over the whole landscape because of the detritus from the mines,
coal dust and the fumes, and
these huge slag heaps, and the smell, and the people were treated like animals. I mean, they worked from a very young age for terrible hours under drastic working conditions. And while he was there, where it was one of the worst explosions and more than 100 people were killed.
Yeah, your description of the explosion was really quite something. I mean, America actually had a pretty bad coal mine explosion not too long ago, but this sounded like an absolutely humongous event that went on.
It was so major, there was quite a bit of literature on it, and where I was headed was that even that desolate, desperate landscape and its people, Vincent transformed in his mind into this sort of magical place. And it was that power of reimagining things that led to, you know, these great works of art. He could, because if he could do that with a mind, you hand him a sunflower, and
yes,
he takes average beauty and turns it into something monumental and epic. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, it reminds me of the photographer Edward Bertinsky, who's done some beautiful work of very industrial landscapes, and sometimes it's difficult when you first look at it to know whether you're looking at something that really is beautiful if you were there, or something horrible, but it has this stark beauty to it from a graphical perspective. What made him want to, I mean, you were talking about Marxists earlier, they would have kind of loved the fact that, you know, Van Gogh rejected his family in many ways, or they rejected him, I'm not sure which, I guess it went both ways, but he ended up, you know, with the lowest societal classes, with coal miners, with low-end prostitutes, people like that. Like, do you know, have any idea what made him want to?
Yes, actually, you know, some of the misinformation that we have about Vincent comes from the novelist Irving Stone, who wrote Lust for Life, which was, you know, a massive bestseller and continues to sell well. And, you know, it was a fantasy to some extent. And I remember reading a passage in which Vincent organizes the workers and marches on the company that runs the mines. And it was really pretty laughable because he couldn't organize, you know, a picnic, let alone a strike or a labor activity.
You described.
And so the reason.
Yeah, go ahead.
the reason he ended up with the sort of these low class prostitutes and these miners and these other afflicted, desperate people was that no one else would have him. It was really out of loneliness. It wasn't. In fact, he really didn't. I mean, there are. It's really quite stunning that he could describe these miners coming home from their terrible days, and there was in the description there is almost no empathy. There's what you get instead is a kind of visual description of it, not unlike the photographs you just described.
Mm-hmm.
His entire reaction to this scene is a visual, poetic one rather than a socially conscious, empathetic one. And you know, one can, you know, if we were judging him as a normal person, we'd be pretty horrified that his first reaction wasn't one of concern for the terrible lives these people had. But you know, he was too damaged himself to really judge him by those standards.
And so he wasn't Emile Zola.
Yes, he wasn't Emile Zola, exactly. Who described this mining era in what I think is generally considered to be the greatest of his novels, Germinal, and he did write that as a kind of attack on the conditions these miners suffered under. And Vincent loved that book, but interestingly, Vincent was pretty focused on sex. The passage you remember from Germinal was of one of the mine managers bedding one of the female workers in the fields. You know, basically, he reads this novel that's about the terrible conditions these miners lived in, and the one incident that he remembers most acutely is the Randy manager taking advantage of these people, and he does it not in horror, but in envy.
Right, and
he's a very complex person.
Right.
Vincent was.
Well, I think one illustrative example, you describe a case where he was in one of these mining villages, and he was trying to get models to paint, and one of his models became pregnant, and the village blamed him, which is probably not an unreasonable suspicion.
No, he did have a relationship. The only two relationships in his life were with seeing this prostitute in The Hague, whom he lived with for about a year, and then there was a peasant girl who actually appeared in The Potato Eaters.
Right.
Her family, including her, they were the subject of that famous early painting, and he did numerous studies of her. So she actually is, there's one in the Norton Simon Museum, a particularly beautiful one, but there are quite a few of Gordina de Groot was her name. And Sean had a child while Vincent was living with her, and it is distant. We did the chronology. It's distantly conceivable that child could have been his, even though his family thought it was his. It's very unlikely. Whereas the child that Gordina de Groot had, we think there's a reasonably good chance that that child was his.
Right. But that offended the morality of the village.
Yes. And the priest, it was a very heavily, even though his father was the Protestant minister, it was a very heavily Catholic region of Holland, and the Catholic priest ordered the peasants to stop having any interaction with Vincent, probably because of his pregnancy, and Vincent left town.
Eventually. Well, I mean, was it the pregnancy or the fact that he was painting women in the nude, which might even be more...
Everything about it, and even just consorting. They had a word in Dutch that basically means declassification, and there was this, anyone who watches Down Abbey knows that the 19th century was more class conscious than our world is today, and not just in England, but everywhere, and there was the horror for everyone was falling down the social ladder, because it was very hard to climb back up it, and so it was considered really not just socially inappropriate, but downright almost criminal to consort with people from a lower social class. And, I mean, you can see this. I'm assuming many of your listeners are watching Downton Abbey or watched it. And you get this strong sense that when Sybil marries the chauffeur, it's just
right.
Inconceivable. And so when Vincent consorted with a peasant, it was even more horrific, because at least Branson took showers or baths, and these peasants didn't. It was just
right.
Considered unacceptable in a way that in our society, especially in Canada and America, where people can pull themselves from one social class into another. Certainly in Europe in the 19th century, this was just, it was
right.
Very difficult.
I mean, I think class still exists. Like, there's certain stores that I go in that I know I don't belong in because I'm not going to drop that much money on, if I was a woman, I would not drop $5,000 on a purse. I don't belong in a store which sells purses.
Another, for $5,000. The class structure still exists.
Yes.
It's just not as impermeable as it was back then.
Yeah, I mean, if I came into a lot of money, then certainly I could walk into a store and drop the money.
Everybody.
Nobody's going to ask you where I came from. What's my heritage?
And the store would be happy to take your $5,000 too.
Yes, they would. I have found that places like that, you get really good service until they realize you're not one of their type.
There's actually a sort of another dimension of this that needs to be discussed, and that is that it's really terribly sad. I mean, he was essentially paying both of these girls and all of these models by the hour, or by the day at least, with Sean, who lived with him for more than a year, and he thought of her as a kind of common law wife.
Right.
He literally continued to pay her a prostitute's wages by the day, and one has to imagine just how sad it was that he lived much of his time in the delusion required to get through the day that he was socially acceptable. He could have startling moments of clarity, and so he knew that these two pathetic women were only available to him because he was paying them, and there were other times in his life when he didn't have anybody, and the he occasionally could save up the money to go to the brothel, but if he wasn't there, there were times and long periods of time when the only social interaction he had was when he ordered his meal from a waitress at a cafe. And you know, just the sheer loneliness. You may have, you know, Harvard's been has done a big study on the factors that contribute to a happy life, and it turns out that the correlation is not between wealth and happiness, or even health and happiness. It's between social interaction and happiness.
Well,
I actually
interviewed a neuroscientist who I was going to mention this earlier. He was an addict for a long time before he got his stuff together and kicked his habits through the love of a good woman, he said. But he also went to a boarding school, and he described the loneliness and how he would deal with the loneliness by going out into the forest with a bottle of vodka and just getting blind drunk. And that's how he started his addictions. But it seemed like an addiction was a response to loneliness.
To the loneliness. I found out after, I was such a nerd in my boarding school that I didn't know that everybody, that so many people were high. Apparently,
right.
It was rather, marijuana was readily available, it turns out. And so, I mean, you've just given me a new explanation for those kids. It wasn't just for the sheer self-indulgence of it. It was they were as miserably lonely as I was, and they found some nice way to deal with it that I didn't. So
yeah, I mean, the problem with an addiction is it becomes that relationship, right? And you want your drugs, and that becomes all you need. And I think that just exacerbates the loneliness. I mean, I guess some drugs like alcohol and marijuana tend to be social drugs, but I don't think heroin's a terribly social drug, but not that I know much about.
I haven't experienced it, but it doesn't look very social to me.
Yes. But there was another, I mean, it would be fascinating to just do a story of Van Gogh and the women in his life, because it was just like one disaster after another. But there was one woman, Margot, who seemed to actually fall in love with him, but for some reason...
Yeah, she was next-door neighbor, and... she was the daughter of the richest man in the town of Noonan, where his father was again the Protestant preacher, and I believe the Begumans were also Protestants, and the father owned the textile industry in that town, which was the leading industry, and there were a couple of unwed sisters. Margot was older than Vincent, and she was she seems to have been mentally unstable herself. So you had these two neighbors, both of them mentally unstable, and she pretty clearly fell in love with Vincent, and he was busy reading another set of novels about a pair of novels about a womanizing department store magnate, and the guy was sort of lauded in these novels. And they were very popular in Europe at the time for his womanizing. And Vincent sort of reimagined himself as this dashing
Lothario.
Lothario.
Yes.
When the family figured out what was happening, they were horrified. And we think there's a very good chance. We discovered some evidence in the Van Gogh Museum archives that indicated that this relationship between the two of them was not just platonic, and she was sent away to Utrecht for about 9 months, leaving a very strong implication, although we couldn't prove it. We couldn't find any records of her medical stay, but the family had a friend who was a doctor in Utrecht, and we think there's a relatively good chance that she was pregnant with Vincent's baby, and that either had an abortion, and it turns out abortions did exist at the time, or equally likely, more likely perhaps, that the baby was given up to an orphanage of some kind.
Right, if it was 9 months, that would seem more likely.
If it was 9 months, one would think that it wasn't just an abortion. It was probably her carrying the child to term and leaving it behind when she returned to her family in Noonan.
Yeah, I mean, she may very well have refused to have an abortion. You know, she felt
it was also, even though it existed, it was even, you can imagine what the attitude was in in the late 19th century.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to get to before we're done. One of them is, another problem he had was his art was not mainstream. There was, I think, still this period of realism, of kind of like photographic-looking art, and that certainly was not Van Gogh's desire. Like, what made him want to do art?
His art was not only unlike the sort of the very mainstream academic art that you're referring to, very realistic, almost photographic art that was the mainstay of the Goupil firm, and that was were the prized objects in the great big salon that was held every year in Paris, where all the artists would exhibit their best works and got prizes and found buyers. But you know, there were, at the time that he arrived in Paris, the Impressionists had come into their own, having themselves defied the rigid concepts of what art should be, with their loosely painted, light-filled canvases. Vincent, even though when he came to Paris, he finally saw their work and decided that he liked the Impressionist work, but he really couldn't be part of any school. And this is where I think his social problems really is an important factor in what he became as an artist, because it was very common for artists, whether they were academic artists and worked in an atelier together, or with students and younger artists they became mentor to, or whether they were just part of a group. I mean, you some of your listeners may know that just as later, Picasso and Braque invented analytical cubism together, and the canvases are similar. Monet and Renoir, painted together and painted very similar canvases. Mm-hmm. And Seurat had a whole circle of planalists around him, and this was not uncommon. There was the whole Panavon school circling around Gauguin, to a lesser extent Bernard. All these other artists could create schools or groups and work together with other artists, and you have this sort of tempering effect of other minds and other ideas and other eyes working together.
And it makes life easier, because you've got students, you've got people who want to paint like you, so they want to pay you to teach them, right?
Whereas poor Vincent, because he couldn't make and keep friends, he also couldn't become part of a school, and so he was independent in a way that few of these other major artists were, and that independence allows him or forces him to create a revolutionary new style. I mean, one of the things that is really important to try to understand, and it was hard for us to understand, was just how shocking Vincent's work looked back then. We've grown up with it, all of us. Because of industrial paint and commercial art, we see bright, and television and the internet, we see intensely bright colors all the time. And we see, we know abstraction, much of this derives from the sensibility that Vincent had as this sole painter working alone, alienated. It's hard for us to imagine just how shocking these canvases were. When Cézanne saw them in a paint store, he was horrified by them. And so it was only in the last year of Vincent's life that anyone, including his brother, really began to take these things seriously. And it was right. It was just within the last year of his life that one symbolist writer began to take Vincent not just seriously, but sort of decided this is the future of art, and this was the greatest living artist around. And his brother submitted several of his canvases to an exhibition in Brussels, and in that year, Claude Monet visited the show. I think he had works in it, and he commented on how interesting Vincent's work was. So at the very tail end of his life, some people were beginning to look at his art again, and after he died, as Theo was going mad with tertiary syphilis,
right.
Theo became an unbelievable admirer of it, belated admirer of his brother's work.
And I guess being an art dealer, I guess he knew how to finally sell it.
Well, he didn't get, because he was so sick in those last months before he died, not that long after Vincent did,
right,
that the person who actually deserves all the credit for this, for making Vincent commercial, was Yolanda Bonger, Theo's wife. And she was the person who did the first and major translation of Vincent's letter. She was a professional translator, an incredibly good one. And so translating the letters into English was absolutely crucial to Vincent's future fame. Those letters, I mean, Irving Stone would not have been drawn to Vincent had it not been for those letters. And she also brilliantly released works into the market at a certain pace.
Right.
And because if you don't get the work out there, people can't see it. And she especially found some German dealers who were willing to show the work, and a whole crowd of art world people in Germany, in particular, very early on, decided that Vincent's art was not just unusual but magnificent, and the whole group of German expressionists comes out of Vincent's work heavily.
And she was also quite a bit younger, wasn't she? She was kind of this young girl that Theo had picked up as a mistress and fell in love with.
She was younger than Theo. I mean, not dramatically younger. He was in his, I believe he was in his late 20s, and she was in her early 20s.
Oh, okay.
It was a staggering age difference, but
okay,
she was definitely younger. And but it was very lucky for Vincent that Theo married this very smart and shrewd and even brilliant woman who did the translations and released the work, and also facilitated scholarship. I mean, she would, it's horrifying for us now, but when a scholar would ask to read one of Vincent's letters, she would just send the letter in the mail and expect the person would return it.
Oh, my God.
And,
yes.
They don't do that at the Van Gogh Museum anymore.
Of course, the concept of having an original of a letter, it's like, I'll just forward you a copy of the email, right? I don't even know what an original is anymore.
Yeah, it's a concept pretty foreign to us. It's, they didn't have Xerox machines.
Yeah, I mean, for correspondence, I mean, it's like I haven't written a social letter in probably 10 years, except a little note in a Christmas card. That's about as far as it goes, the thought of sitting down for an hour to write a letter to my mother.
To do what they did do, when Vincent wanted to send, but famously he would send drawings of paintings that he was doing, because there was no way, you couldn't photograph them and, you know, forward them from your phone to your friend's phone or your brother's phone. So he would do a drawing of a painting that he was doing and then send it to Theo and to Bernard and to an Australian painter named Russell, for example. And there are several examples of him doing this three different times. He had to send the same letter to three. He would have to copy it over by hand, and he would have to make the drawing over by hand. And what's astonishing is that he was such a genius that he tailored each drawing to the interests and the taste of the person who was getting the letter, so that Theo's version of the drawing was one thing, and Bernard's and Russell's was different. And Bernard, for example, who was into both Quasianism and, to a certain extent, into Pointillism, you know, Vincent's work would become a little Quasianist or a little Pointillist.
Can you define those terms? Because I don't know what
those mean. Yeah, Quasianism was sort of, it's based on enamel work. And you don't have little metal lines contain areas of enamel. There were a group of painters around Vincent, and he did some Quasianist works himself, where they basically were flat planes of color delineated.
A little bit like Cubism?
Well, it helps lead to Cubism, but it's prior to Cubism, and it's basically, instead of looking at an object in three dimensions, if heavily based on Japanese prints, it renders them essentially in two dimensions with blocks of color.
Mm-hmm.
And Pointillism is basically painting in dots of color that confuse in the eye. Basically, the famous Pointillist was Seurat. If people know the Sunday on La Grande Jatte, that gave rise to the Sondheim musical Sunday in the Park with George, the panelists decided that you could that vision was a matter of light bouncing off of subjects and in pure colors and fusing in the eye in a way that that brings those disparate colors together. And if you painted this way, they felt they could give you a better simulation of a light filled existence. And those paintings do have a wonderful luminous quality. And anyway, they were so I had a bunch of followers. And Vincent tried to paint some planless canvases, but because he couldn't follow in anyone's lead, he would just use the planalism in some parts of the canvas and then forget what he was doing and do something else in another part of the canvas. And it ended up being far less, he wasn't able to follow any style mechanically. He could not be himself.
Right.
And although there was structure, but it was his own structure.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that you can see in these paintings is that the result of spending a day or a night in bed thinking about what the next day's painting was going to look like, and he would structure it in his mind, the composition and what kind of paint strokes he would use and what the palette, what the colors mm-hmm. would be. But then when he was in front of the canvas, this genius of a mind of his could work, you could literally load hundreds, thousands of brush strokes of paint working wet onto a canvas and finish the canvas in several hours. And it was a combination of a very, not a disciplined mind, but a focused mind in coming up with the structure of the work, and then this lightning skill in making color combinations and in determining the thickness of a stroke and the width of a stroke and how one stroke feeds into another stroke, wet, that creates these unbelievable masterpieces. And but it was a genius that didn't conform to any
right.
other previous style.
We've kind of come to the end of our time, and I had wanted to talk about his death, but I think maybe I'll leave that for people who want to read your book, which is called Van Gogh: The Life, and you wrote it jointly with Gregory White Smith. I mean, I started thinking I just wanted to talk about the mystery of his death, this great artist who did he commit suicide? Did he get murdered? Was it an accident? Whatever. But I actually found his life a lot more fascinating than I thought I would, which also says I think the life of an artist is important in understanding their work. You can't really, like, I think my appreciation now of Van Gogh's work is going to be much deeper because I know a little bit about the turmoil of his life.
Well, Vincent himself thought that. He once said that the man the person behind the canvas was more important than the canvas itself. So it's an attitude that Greg and I certainly share with you, and we all share with Vincent, who believed this so ardently.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing this information with me and my audience, and I encourage everybody, if they're interested in art, and especially Van Gogh, to read your book, and you also have other art books if people want to do that as well.
Yeah, the Jackson Pollock, the one the Pulitzer, was important to us as well. Those are the two key books, and
yeah.
David, thank you so much for the pleasure of this discussion.
Yes, and I'll send you a link to the MP3 when it's up.
Terrific. David, thank you so much.
Okay, have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 105 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.